Hey, this is WTOP's Jason Fraley, and we are being joined by, just say your name and your title.
My name's David Muse. I'm the artistic director at Studio, and I directed our production of Fun Home.
Running at Studio Theater now through August 27th. Hey, thanks so much for joining us, David.
Yeah, nice to be here.
Now, we might have one of the actors, Bobby, join us in a minute. If so, we'll just, you know, seamlessly weave him in here. But we can at least get started. And let's talk about the show before we get to, you know, the Studio Theater version and, you know, your all's take on it. Tell me, you know, remind us a little of the backstory, because I think I saw it. Gosh, it wasn't Broadway. It was National Theater, I think, a couple years ago in like 2017. And I guess it had just, you know, cleaned up at the Tonys or whatever. But I remember being blown away. It was one of my favorite musicals I've seen like in the last decade. But remind our listeners when it came out on Broadway and how big of a damn deal it was.
Yeah, it was a huge deal. 2012 is, I think, when a production of it happened at the Public Theater in New York. And, you know, it was a huge success there. They transferred it to Broadway not too long after that original run. So it was running on Broadway, I don't know, 2013, 2014, something like that. It won the Tony for Best Musical in addition to something like four others. Yeah, and it was a great big smash. And then it went on a national tour. So, which means that it played the national, I don't know, 2016, 2017. It also means that, you know, very often a successful show in New York eventually winds up at one of the theater companies in Washington for a sort of DC production. And that never happened with Fun Home, right? The national tour came through, but we hadn't kind of done a more local production of the play in the way it bypassed DC and its theaters. So, you know, a few years later, we thought, maybe it's time. And particularly with a musical like this one, where I could imagine a way to do it that like didn't just feel like a derivative version of that Broadway production, where I actually felt like there was a kind of interesting way to turn it into a studio production. It had a great appeal. And like you, I loved it when I saw it originally.
How can you not? I mean, seriously, it is.
Exactly.
It's captivating. And you know, maybe... Yeah. You know, tell our listeners sort of the basic premise, because, you know, when you hear Fun Home, you might not realize, oh, do I want to see a show about a funeral home? But I'm telling you, folks, it's so much. There's so much more about the, you know, the writer, you know, grappling with her own, you know, identity, sexuality, relationship with her closeted gay father. There's like so much going on in terms of LGBTQ stuff. But I'll let you say it. You know, give us the basic premise of, you know, the setup, like who the characters are, the setting, all that stuff.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, the quick version is it's a musical about Alison Bechdel, who is a cartoonist, a graphic novelist, and she's working on actually her first standalone graphic novel, Fun Home, which is an actual published graphic novel. And the musical is about her working on it and trying to process her father's death and to make art out of her past. Allison's father was a closeted gay man. And Allison learned that about 4 months before he killed himself. Mm. And now she's gonna write this graphic novel about like him and growing up and coming out. And all of that in a way makes it feel a little more serious than it is. I mean, ultimately it is, you know, quite serious, the things that it's dealing with, but there's also a real kind of irreverence and fun-heartedness about the thing throughout it. Throughout the course of the musical, we see Allison played by three different actors at three different phases of her life. So you've got the kind of young Allison Bechdel when she's 9 or 10, you've got the college age Allison Bechdel when she's just, you know, started at Oberlin College. And then you got the adult version of herself when she's 43 and working on a graphic novel.
Oh, and it is, I mean, I'm getting goosebumps hearing you describe the story, because I'm just remembering sitting in the theater there at National Theater and watching it. And It is. It just packs an emotional wall of it. But like you're saying, it is more upbeat and fun. It is true to the title. It is a fun show. Don't get me wrong, folks. Yeah. But it's the catharsis. It is tear jerking. It's also funny and fun. Like, it is every emotion you could want from a show, and you leave you leave enlightened. So yeah, go into some of the music. Let's start with the title number. You know. Come to the fun home, the Bechdel funeral home, baby. Yeah. Talk about how much fun it is. It's like an invitation to the audience to what you're in for.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the music is terrific. It's the composer is Janine Tesori, who's like arguably the most important living composer working in the American musical theater. Just won her second Tony Award, actually, at the last Tony Award ceremony. And she's terrific, and she also does this interesting thing where she frequently collaborates with playwrights who aren't normally lyricists, who are like just interesting writers, and she works with them on these musicals, and that's what she's done with Fun Home, the woman who writes the book of the musical and the lyrics of the songs is named Lisa Krohn. She's a playwright. This is her first musical, and as a result, it's sort of like, doesn't feel exactly like a musical on some level. Like it feels like a play that's sung.
Right.
It's also quirky and lyrically sophisticated. And, you know, the music is a little bit hard to, in a way, just encapsulate because it goes all over the place. There's like, because it's set these various eras, she gets to have some fun with, you know, 70s and 80s and contemporary stuff and pastiche and, you know, it's like, it's trying not to be on some level, traditional feeling musical. But then every once in a while it lets itself be in a kind of knowing way, and gets to have some fun with that. So it's a, you know, it's a little bit of an all over the place score in a good way. But it's also hummable and delightful, and the lyrics are just forget about it. Interesting.
Oh, yeah. And that's a great, you know, everything you just said is a perfect soundbite for, you know, just an overview of the whole, you know, of the songbook and the music in general. If you could, I would love to throw out a couple song titles and do if you could give me just a deeper dive on song specific songs. So I mentioned, well, real quick, a follow up just so I have options to use. I know we kind of already went, but tell me about Come to the Fun Home, how it's like the three Bechdel kids and it's a bit like a Jackson 5 number or something.
That's exactly what it is. And the score says that specifically, like this has a Jackson 5 vibe. The conceit is that these three, you know, kind of quirky, precocious kids in Beach Creek, Pennsylvania have come up with a commercial to advertise this funeral home that her father runs. At that time, what they would have been exposed to a lot is the Jackson 5. So that's kind of like what they're riffing on. And they come up with, you know, they sort of sing a 3 or 4 minute commercial for the fun home in Jackson 5 style. So what you've got is these three kids, aged just over and under 10 years, like singing and dancing and putting on a number. And it absolutely steals the show every night. Because I mean, they're so fun and talented and the lyrics are amazing. And when do you see that? You know, these like three 10-year-olds who were just given the stage and they do a number with no adults on, you know, stage at all, for 4 minutes, just singing and dancing and making jokes. And the audience eats it up.
Totally. Another standout number for me is so what you just described, like the younger Allison and the kids, medium Allison, if we'll call it that, medium aged Allison, does Changing My Major, and it's funny, but it's also, you know, it's sort of her awakening, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. It's like, it's a sexual awakening, and it's also a kind of coming out style awakening, where like both of those things are happening in her life. She's just, gotten together with a woman for the first time in her life. And She's singing about everything she's going through. And it's both like such a moving kind of becoming yourself song, and like stepping into a new identity. And it's also like hugely recognizable song for any of us, you know, who are like having a first sexual experience. And then, yeah, and the conceit of the song is that she's not going to be a student anymore. She's just going to change her major to Joan and spend the rest of the semester in this dorm room with her.
I love it. All right, hang on. I think Bobby's here. Hey, Bobby, can you hear us?
Hello.
Hey, thanks for joining us.
Hi, David.
Hi, Bobby.
Hey, so David's doing awesome. You know, we're rocking it here about we've already knocked out the premise and the Broadway backstory, and now we're going through a couple of the songs. So I'll throw it to you, Bobby. We did come to the fun home and changing my manger. So Bobby, tell me about Ring of Keys. Why it's such a powerful song, and it's like a visual storytelling song.
Yeah, I think Ring of Keys is important. I'm not sure, you know, they talk about people in theater talk about how groundbreaking the show was because of a lesbian protagonist. And but I came to I sit on stage for Ring of Keys every night, and I'm not sure that I have ever heard a song written for a 10-year-old to sing about their questioning of who they are and what they might be and how it might feel just to identify with somebody you, and I'm putting this in quotes, who you know. And I think that's pretty groundbreaking too. It's a very innocent song, and it's beautifully sung by Quinn.
Absolutely. Well, maybe time for one more song. We have to touch, I mean, to me, the, you know, the big goosebump chill inducing culminating number, Telephone Wire, where Allison's remembering her final car ride with her father, you know, before he committed suicide, and just pleading for him to say something at the light.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's burned in my brain. It's one of the most powerful moments in theater I've ever seen. Yeah, I mean, just why do you think that one is so powerful? I mean, you play the father, who committed suicide.
I think it's the communication barrier. I think that we all experience. I think that's one of the reasons the show can be universal, because of that barrier that you might have between a family member or a father or a mother, and you both need to say something to each other, and the wires are well, not the telephone wire, but the wires are just crossing, and I think it's sad when you get to a place in your life where you can't communicate, but it happens to so many of us. So maybe that's it. I mean, for me, that's what it is.
Yeah. And since you're playing the father, the late father, Bruce Bechtel, we're seeing, you know, a daughter going through her own, you know, sexuality, you know.
Yeah.
But your character, because of the time that you, I guess, grew up just generationally, felt he couldn't come out of the closet, you know, and then ultimately killed himself. Presumably, I mean, I assume because of how hard it is to live in that era, you know. So now hopefully she's coming up in an era where maybe she can be more herself.
Yeah, I think there's a period of time in there when it hits the father, it hits Bruce, it hits me, and that, you know, it's so much easier. There's a line about I'm envious of the newfound freedoms that appear on college campuses today, and he even says in a scene, he's like, you know, we just didn't label it, we didn't say, we thought everybody should experiment, you know, that's okay, but we don't have to put a label on it, because by putting a label on it, it makes you ostracized, you know. And so I think, you know, I don't think I was born when Bruce was. I think I'm a bit younger, I hope. But anyway, the idea that there was, you know, you had to either go to a bar or you had to test the waters with people on the street, because there was nothing else you could do. And that kind of longing, that kind of absence of human contact is which is not fulfilled with his wife. I'm sure he likes his wife fine, but it's where society put him. So I think it's a huge deal because he looks at his daughter and he goes, it's so much easier for you than it was for me. And meanwhile, he thinks he's a bad person. He says it in the play, I'm bad. And that comes from a lot of, you know, a lot of pounding on yourself and your soul and your emotions. So that's where I'm going with it. Did that make any sense?
Totally. And it's not just pounding on yourself and beating yourself up. It's society pounding on you and enforcing that. And sort of to that point, we're talking about, you know, how hopefully, you know, Allison's generation, you know, has it a little more free and open, but here we are, you know, maybe that was true at the time the show was on Broadway in 2015. I mean, actually, yeah, 2015 was the year the Supreme Court struck down the bans on same-sex marriage. And, you know, the White House and the Obama administration, you know, had rainbow colors on, lit up the White House that day. And here we are, gosh, almost a decade later, and it almost seems, I don't know, speak to that a little bit. Do you fear, and the importance of doing this show at Studio Theater too, like, do you fear that we're backsliding and now the Supreme Court might be, maybe we're entering an era where the Bruce Bechdels are worried again?
I think so. I think, well, you know, the idea that even though Allison in our play has it an easier time of being who she is, I also think each generation that comes after has a little bit easier time. However, we're still talking about this play. We're still talking about that this play is a surprising play because there's a lesbian protagonist and there's a kid talking about her sexuality. That's not a huge deal. If that's as far as we've come and yet we're being set back, yeah. I'm a little skeptical of what might happen. And I hate to say that. And I like to keep a positive attitude, and I think I will.
But that's why it's important. And David, jump back in, David, too, as the director. Like, and just talk about why. I mean, to me, that's why it's important for theaters like Studio Theater to continue to do these shows year after year, because they take on new meanings, because society and the context that they're being staged within changes for good and for bad. We make progress, then we take two steps back. And just talk about why that's why you need to be directing the show right now, David.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, 2 days before we opened this play, the Supreme Court said it was okay to not make a wedding website for a gay couple in Colorado. you know, and one of the things that made me feel, because this was a play we were originally going to produce in 2020, and the pandemic shut it down. The set was half built, you know, and it took us sort of 3 years to get back to a moment when we could produce the play. And a little bit, I feel like there was a blessing there. Because suddenly we are in a different political context than we were a few years ago. And, you know, certain rights and privileges do feel a little bit more tenuous, at least to me. So if anything, it's become, you know, that much more kind of active and alive, the themes of this play. And to be clear, it doesn't feel like a political play. I mean, I think it kind of can't help but be.
Right. It's not preachy.
It's not agenda driven. It's a human story. Yeah. You know, one of the actors who was in the original company said, listen, this is not a play for anyone. It's really just a play for people who've been parents or who've been children.
Exactly.
That's true about it too. I mean, it does have the kind of remarkable thing about it is that it was so groundbreaking in its way, and that it is a play that doesn't in any way try to soft pedal its content for a mainstream audience. And at the same time, it can be more or less universally beloved.
Yeah, that's so true. And thanks for mentioning that. That yes, it just happens that this family in this story is dealing, you know, with sexuality and things like that, but it could be a proxy for any generational trauma, or, you know, and anyone, I bet people that audiences come and see Fun Home are going to probably take different things out of it and think of things that they wish they told their parents, or their wish their parents told them, I guess, at the light. People probably have their own memories of various things left unsaid, or, you know, whatever, regrets, or like, I truly, thanks for saying that. Like, it's going to relate universally, as well as the macro and the micro on this, I think.
Yeah. I think meeting people at the level they are, meeting these characters, meeting a family is powerful, and you get to see them on a human level, and that's what's most important to me. That's what I feel when I do the show, David. I don't know how you felt when you sit in the audience.
Yeah, I mean, if you can't hear my voice, it just was profoundly moving to me. And you know, here I am, a straight white man, but it just affected me. And I, you know, I just I invite everybody to come to go see it. It is powerful. You know, whatever stripe or political you think you are, preconceived notions, like, you have to come out to Studio Theater and see this. It is one of the greatest musicals I've ever friggin' seen. Well, let's close with that then. Just talk about why Studio Theater is such a, you know, a vital, not only a jewel of a theater in town, but just, you know, a vital piece of the city.
Thank you for describing us like that, Jason. I mean, I think this play at Studio Theater is, you know, I think a good example of when we feel, you know, quite vital and feel like we do our thing particularly well. And that's, I do think if you manage to, you know, come take a look, it's going to feel like a different thing than, you know, its production at the National, which I'm sure was also terrific. But experiencing a play like this in a small room with 200 people, when you are probably at most 35 feet away from the actors who are doing it, and you're part of this like collective presence, and you can see other people in the audience, and it takes a play that's powerful and just turns it into an almost communal experience with a small group of people. And I think that's one of the things that people come to the Studio Theater for, because, you know, it's not every day that you get to experience a musical like this one in an environment like that. And I think when it works, it like takes all of the human themes that we're talking about, and really just amplifies them, and lets you like feel other people feel what they do when they experience it. So it's a powerful thing, at least for me, you know, to be in a room like this. And this play, it like represents so many things that I think when we do our thing well, Studio does, which is, you know, do a play that is like thematically sophisticated and well-crafted and lyrically complicated and emotionally rewarding, and, you know, present it with a terrific company of actors, including Bobby Smith.
Thank you, David.
Especially Bobby Smith, right?
Thank you, David. Oh yeah, he left that out.
and deliver it in this little intimate environment, and that also, that, you know, while it's happening, it takes people of like kind of all backgrounds and all stripes, but particularly people who have had coming out experiences of their own, and just makes them feel, you know, seen and on some level celebrated because of it.
Absolutely. Perfectly said. Perfect place to leave it. Yes. I mean, folks, Fun Home is going to blow you away. You have to go see it at Studio Theater. It's going to run now through August 27th. So get your tickets now. Hey, David and Bobby, thank you so much for doing this. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jason.
Sure thing, Jason. Nice talking to you.